Good to see you this morning and to have each of you in this assembly. To those whose names have been mentioned as ill and needing our prayers, I'd like to add one more that is a concern to our own family, and that is Wilma's brother, James Nelms, who was in India, south of New Delhi, and he and his companions in the vehicle, the taxi they were in, were struck head-on by a truck, I think, and two were killed, and he was severely injured, but he has been now returned to California and to the hospital there, and we would appreciate your prayers on his behalf. This morning is the fourth in a series of studies from the book of Ecclesiastes, which we can describe aptly as wisdom for the ages. We believe the book was written by Solomon and that only he could fill out the qualifications of the writer as he describes himself. And we believe that his intention is to cause others not to take the course he took in his life, which resulted in untold harm to himself and to others. It is a study that he writes down, I think, clearly by the guidance of the Holy Spirit, of his own pilgrimage to find ultimate worth under the sun. What we have looked at so far is that first elemental truth of Ecclesiastes, and that is that everything under the sun, when looked at as something that's going to last forever, is not going to last forever. Everything here that we can touch and experience is temporary and unsatisfying to the human spirit, and therefore to build your life on money or to build your life on pleasure or to build your life on worldly wisdom or power is an exercise in foolishness and emptiness, what Solomon calls vanity, feasting or striving after the wind. And as he begins his book, so he concludes the book about things under the sun, it's all vanity and emptiness. But we learn something else in our study, that not only should we set God at the center of things, which is the foremost of all precepts, fear God and keep His commandments, Solomon concludes in Ecclesiastes 12:13. For this is the whole of man. Now that is vital. That lesson we cannot miss in Ecclesiastes. Fear God, he says more than once. And though the wicked live 100 years, he says it's the righteous that will come forth at last. And we have to learn to look above the sun into the regions of divine wisdom and power in order to realize final, just, and equitable conclusions of life. It's not here that that happens. But we learned in our last study that Solomon is not cynical about the things that are here for us to use. He says they are the gifts of God, and we ought to enjoy them and thank God for them. We ought to take pleasure in our work, which we have to do here, daily occupations. Man is made for work. We ought to take joyful delight and receive with gratitude the money that God provides to us, the clothing that He provides, the families that He gives us. And because they are the gifts of God, we ought to be deeply grateful for them, but we ought to realize that these things cannot be counted on as lasting. So use them and enjoy them wisely and graciously, and I might add, with a disposition to be benevolent toward others. Don't be cynical. And don't look on these things as just without purpose and without use. But there's another dimension that I want us to look at today. You know, Solomon, in the last chapter of Ecclesiastes, just before he comes to his last observation in verse 9, says, and further, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words and that which was written uprightly, even words of truth. Now, one thing we have learned in Ecclesiastes, that the wisdom of the world, the human craftiness, and I don't mean by that anything that's untoward, but being prudent, is something that has value. It doesn't have ultimate value, just as the prudence of men. But Solomon tells us in his discourse on lasting things, ultimate things, that wisdom has advantage. He says it in the 7th chapter in verse 11. Wisdom is as good as an inheritance. Yes, more excellent is it for them that see the sun. For wisdom is a defense, even as money is a defense, but the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Solomon says there that wisdom is better than money, that good sense is better than treasure. And I think we must raise the level of the wisdom when Solomon speaks as he does in that last chapter, and he's talking about wisdom that comes out of that preeminent foundation, and that's fearing God. Now, that's what he said in the Proverbs, and there are Proverbs in Ecclesiastes, but Solomon in Proverbs chapter 1 verse 7 says the beginning of wisdom or knowledge is the fear of the Lord. And he repeats it again in Proverbs 9 and verse 10. That's the foundation. If you don't get that right, nothing else is going to be right. Paul warns in the first chapter of Romans that the ancient Roman world, Gentile world, Greek world, had decided that they wouldn't have God in their knowledge, and after that their minds never worked right again. They were darkened in their understanding, he said. And so, we understand this morning, we must understand this morning, that the foundation of all things wise is that first acknowledgement that God must be feared and reverenced above all else. And that is not some deep wisdom difficult for men to grasp. If God exists, you and I know that he ought to take first place in our lives and everything we think and feel and do. In the 9th chapter, verses 17 and 18, the conclusion of the 9th chapter, the words of the wise, heard in quiet, are better than the cry of him that rules among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. There he's saying simply that wisdom has its advantages. Now, I always like to read chapter 10, verses 12 through 15, because it gives such expression to the vagaries and the stupidities of the fool. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow him up. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. A fool also multiplies words. Yet man does not know what shall be, and that which shall be after him, who can tell him? The labor of fools wearies every one of them, for he does not know how to go to the city. Now, what he's saying here is that he doesn't know the way to town. Obvious thing. The fool doesn't know. And the reason is that he never learns anything from his experience of life. And he's not willing to take any correction. And if you make your company with people like that who never listen to anything, who get no instruction out of the experience of others, and who don't even get instruction out of their own experience, then life is going to be very difficult indeed. The statement is made in Ecclesiastes that if the axe is dull, then you put more force. But that's the work of a fool. We need to sharpen the axe instead of increasing our labor, which becomes at last emptiness. And that's the reason that the labor fools always wears them out, because they never do things in a wise and prudent way. And Solomon and his author, the one who gives him this wisdom, wants us to be wise. And I would like to take up at that point today and talk about some of the wise counsels that are given in Ecclesiastes. First of all, in our attitude toward things, if you would turn to the fourth chapter. And there's just a brief section there on this subject. Now, we've already discussed things as ultimate value, and we've learned from Solomon that those that love silver will not be satisfied with silver, and those that love abundance will not be satisfied with increase. We've learned, too, that wealth is easily taken away, or we're taken away from it. Or that we save our money and hoard it up only to leave it to somebody who has no concern or care about it whatsoever and doesn't deserve a penny of it. And it's foolish to do that. Utterly foolish. But here he says, "Then I saw all labor and every skillful work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind." I think what he's talking about there is this disposition for us to want to keep up with the Joneses. Now, Joneses is spelled J-O-N-E-S-E-S. You know, I didn't have room to put that in there. So you just put it in. Keeping up with the Joneses, that is a proverb in our world that everybody understands. To keep up with the Joneses means that I always look next door, or if I see something down the block, or if I just happen to see something across town that somebody else has, it is my dream and passion to try to have what everybody else has. I envy other people. In fact, I set my standard of what I deserve by what I see other people having. And so that's how my life is driven. That is utter madness. There never will be any contentment, as Solomon has indicated, because you will always see something else somebody has you don't have. And so we stack our houses full of things we never use, basements and attics filled with things we thought we could not live without. But now they take up space and have no useful employment. And as we live longer, so the collection grows. And I want to say to young people who are thinking how wonderful this is, who are living with simple furniture that sometimes needs to be glued back together, who are living with appliances that you have to know exactly what to do or the thing ain't going to work. You got to know which wire to twist, where to hit and bang. And you're saying to yourself, this is bad. I see all these other people with their gleaming chrome filled. No, that's not the style now. No chrome today. We've got to have white throughout. And the kitchen must have all the glories of whiteness. Now, next year, the appliance makers will get a new color, and everything you've got will be absolutely passé. Remember all those gold appliances and those almond appliances, all those green appliances. They've been feeding us on that. Now, you're thinking to yourself, this is what I need, and we're suffering so much from this, and you know the car is in the same condition, and you think, well, one of these days is not going to bring you anything but a lot of things that don't mean anything. Meanwhile, you spend an enormous amount of money on things that do not matter. So don't live your life looking around and trying to figure out what the other fellow has that you want for yourself so that you can be unhappy till you get it. I know that our economy, I know that capitalistic society, I know that the market feeds on that kind of longing and desire, and advertising is poured out upon us to get us to be discontent with life as we now know it. But I want to tell you that Solomon is saying to you, be wise. That's not the way. And what we have done, and this is so unfortunate, because we've got every bank in the United States sending us a letter. You have already been approved for $5,000 worth of credit on our credit card, which for the first 6 months, meaningless of course, will only cost you 6% interest. That goes up 25%. And we have taken our credit card and we've spent money we did not have, and we've borrowed from Peter to pay Paul, and we still owe Paul. And we're in financial bond servitude. Now, to those who find themselves in that position, and I suspect all of us at one point or another in our lives have found ourselves just exactly there, I don't think any of us can lift our eyes to heaven and say, you know, would that all men were as wise as I and never made a mistake financially. But I'm saying to you that you don't want to continue that. That's not the way to live. It is wretched. It is miserable. And Solomon has given us wise counsel here. Well, there is an opposite extreme to that one that Solomon addresses in this chapter. And I want it understood. I had to think a while before I used this language. It was brief, but you've got to understand that there are times when it's not dishonorable at all to live on welfare. That's the only way you can make it. We're talking here, and I think Solomon is talking here in this statement, when he says the fool folds his hands together and eats his own flesh. He's talking about the sluggard. He's talking about the individual who's saying, I just live off the dole. I am not interested in doing anything for myself. I have no ambitions to bear my own load. It's the duty and responsibility of other people to take care of me. The childish attitude. I'm speaking about the attitude that is opposite of that which is expressed by the Apostle Paul in 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 10, when he says, if any will not work, neither let him eat. That's a biblical principle. I'm talking about people who have no interest whatsoever in doing what they can do. That is a miserable way to live. It's not a righteous way to live. People who do not take responsibility to carry their load, or at least to do the best they can, are people who will never grow up. They'll always be dependent children. They'll always be resentful of everybody else and blame everybody else for the trouble that they have. It's not an attitude that is godly. It's one that will lead to a spirit of bitterness, that will dry up the milk of human kindness in you. And if you think it'll make you more compassionate to others, you are mistaken. People who think of themselves as being the just object of everybody else's generosity, who feel themselves victimized by circumstance, are not people who will look toward others with a spirit of compassion and generosity, because they have looked so long to themselves and focused so long upon their own needs that they cannot think about anyone else. So, don't be guilty of lazy indolence. Remember the language of Solomon in Proverbs, go to the ant, you sluggard. And take some wisdom even from the animal kingdom, that there's a time to provide and to be prudent and to take care of your own needs. And if you can't do more than that, then there is every reason why you should have help, because you're trying to help yourself and you can't. There are times when we cannot. Simple truth. And when that's the case, the generosity of others is absolutely right. But the thing we need to find, I think, is what he mentions in verse 6. Better is a handful and quietness than two handfuls with labor and striving after wind. So you've got one handful and you're looking at the other hand, it's empty. And you're thinking to yourself, I've got to fill this other hand. Don't think that way. Just take that one handful and in quiet contentment, accept what God has given with joy. And remember the language of Paul to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, when he says, "But godliness with contentment is great gain." Godliness with contentment is great gain. It is not enough to serve God on the one hand, or to feel we're serving God on one hand, and on the other hand, to be constantly discontent about what we have. Be content with such things as you have, is the language of the writer of Hebrews in chapter 13. And I'll tell you, if ever we learn a sense of gratitude for what God has done for us, I think the contentment will come, and we will savor every little bite of food, and we will delight in every hour of peaceful sleep, and we'll be grateful for every moment we can spend during the day doing useful labor, that we have the health to do it and the mind to do it. And as long as that is true, we will give thanks to God and rejoice in His presence, and say to Him with absolute confidence and assurance, "You do things well. And you have provided for me graciously and wisely." And things will happen inside our spirits, inside our hearts, that will make us better people, good people, earnest people, and I might add, happy people. Well, he goes next to the subject of the value of friends. A little bit of a puzzle to me. Why some people hold everyone else at arm's length and seem to say, "Well, I just don't need anything and I don't need anybody." Well, the truth of the matter is, we need everything. In the sense that we could not by our own devices gain one single need that we have. Only by God's goodness is that possible. But we also need other people. We are born into families with a mother and a father who must nurture us, and if they don't, somebody else must, into human life. And without other people, we couldn't even be human. They're the ones who, by attending to us and interacting with us, that bring us to maturity as human beings. And anybody who says he's done what he's done on his own is a fool. So there's a need. There's a need, Solomon says, for friends. Starting with verse 7, "Then I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There is one that is alone, and he hath not a second. Yea, he hath neither son nor brother. Yet is there no end of all his labor, neither are his eyes satisfied with riches." The irony he presents here is the man who's stacking up money, doesn't have anybody to leave it to. You know, it's just a point that he's gotten into a habit. And some of us have gotten into this habit, and that's the reason that sometimes our resources, even as Christians, are stored up somewhere in some bank when they ought to be put to use serving God. Local churches that store up money in a treasury year after year after year, saying there might be an emergency, we're going to be generous someday, are sinning in what they're doing, because those resources need to be given. But now in verse 9, "Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor." I believe that's true. I know I've mentioned this before, but have you ever been on a trip and experienced something that was so tremendous and you just wish you had somebody to tell it to, and there's nobody? Nobody to share it with? Joy shared are twice as large, I think. And that's the reason God made marriage. And it's the reason He made families. And it's the reason He made the family of God, as a matter of fact. Because two are better than one. If we have to do it alone, if we have to walk in a solitary way as a Christian and no one to help us, we'll do that by the power and grace and support of God. But that's not the ideal way. God's put us together with other Christians. And we need to cultivate friends. We need to be open to those relationships. And I believe one translation of a particular proverb is that the way to have friends is to be friendly. Well, I'm not sure that's the accurate translation of Hebrew, but that's been the subject of many a sermon. And if we're going to have others draw near to us, we have to draw near to them. But we often stand back and say, nobody spoke to me. Well, did you speak to anyone? Well, they didn't act like they wanted me to. Well, how do you know? You didn't act like you wanted anybody to speak to you. You were over there just sort of quietly in the corner, and nobody saying a word. You're not saying a word to anybody else. If we are going to have friends, we have to express our interest in others. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. And then they help each other as a consequence. Verse 10, for if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falls and does not have another to lift him up. But the fear of old people who are no longer strong. What is the fear? The fear, if they're living alone, that if they fall somewhere, they won't be able to get to anybody to get help. And so arrangements are often made in that instance. I'm not speaking against older people living by themselves. I think when the time comes, I'm not going to go move in with anybody else, and I won't stay where I'm going to stay. I have a disposition. I'm sure that that's the way it's going to be, and I'm my children, Lord bless them. It'll be hard. I'm trying now not to be the kind. I don't want to be an old, ornery old man. And my wife is never going to be that. She's going to be a sweet, dear lady right to the end. But now that's another story, and I'm working on it. I'm working on this. But you know, we need each other. We need each other, and there's no shame in that. There is no shame in that. And so there needs to be this sharing of life because we help each other. And you see, if the other fellow, I need to be thinking about how I can help somebody else. And not about how they can help me. Because if I think about how I can help others, the other take care of itself. And friendships will develop and close ties will develop. And the wonderful thing about Christians is John in his third epistle refers to Christians as friends. The friends greet you. And that's what we are. Jesus is our friend. He's made us friends to each other. There is a value here. The joy of the companionship, of course, is obvious. In verse 11, again, if two lie together, then they have warmth. But how can one be warm alone? I understand that it's talking about on a cold night, you know, it's a three-dog night, we used to talk about. That means three dogs on the bed, try to keep warm. And that, I think there's a rock band by that name, is there not? I'm not too up on that particular matter. But the point of it all is we warm each other, and not just physically, we warm each other emotionally. And we warm each other spiritually. That's wisdom. Don't live life by yourself. It's emptiness when you can live with others and have association with other people. And don't stay alone. Reach out to other people. And they will reach out to you because we have that need. And the strength, of course, of togetherness is obvious. And if a man prevail against him that is alone, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. I believe you can see that wisdom certainly here in Solomon, and I think you can see this wisdom portrayed in the gospel, that there is that. Here's something that may not be the most profound of all things, but you know, sometimes we get to the point where we believe that we are virtually irreplaceable. I know a gospel preacher, older gospel preacher, able gospel preacher. But the church where he was decided they need to find a new man. He thought he was irreplaceable, and he thought, well, now they'll find out. That they really have cast away the man who was above all others, and that they're not going to be able to replace me. They got a young man in there who had very little experience. I knew the young man too. And that church grew like crazy. And they didn't seem to miss him at all. Good lesson. And I try to take that to heart. What is said here, better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who does not know how to receive admonition anymore. For out of prison he came forth to be king. Yes, even in his kingdom he was born poor. I saw all the living that walk under the sun that were with the youth, the second that stood up in his stead. There was no end of all the people, even of all them that were over whom he was. Now, could this be Solomon talking about Jeroboam? I don't know. He was, in fact, he was that old and foolish king who wouldn't take admonition anymore. And this poor youth by the name of Jeroboam, who had to flee the country to get outside Solomon's grasp. And before Solomon died, he perhaps was prescient enough to see that's what's going to happen. Because I've been an idiot. And I thought I could just have my way and do anything I want to do, tax these people out of all fairness, and do what I wanted to do. And now this young fellow didn't have any background at all. He's up here and he's going to take over everything. Well, we need to remember, we're not irreplaceable. Mordecai made that point to Esther in Esther chapter 4, verse 13 and 14. He said, who knows, but for such a time as this, God has brought you to the kingdom, or you've been brought to the kingdom. The word God doesn't appear there ever in the book of Esther, and yet we feel his presence more profoundly than in some other books. Who knows, but what you've been brought to the kingdom for such a time as this. But he said, if you do not choose to go into the king and so to act to deliver your people from this horror that Haman is conspiring to bring upon the whole of the nation of God's people, God will raise up help from some other quarter. So we need to be humble. I'll just let that be sufficient admonition from that quarter. We take up one that is a bit more significant, it seemed to me, and that is worshiping God thoughtfully. Chapter 5, he begins by saying, keep your foot when you go to the house of God. That does talk about be sure you don't stumble over the seats, or that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about watching your behavior when you come in the presence of God, so that you don't offer the sacrifice of fool. What is the sacrifice of fool? Well, he is here. He's here because he's here because he's here. He's been here a lot. It is his habit to be here. That's about all it is. It's a mindless ritual. He has no sense of reverential awe for being in the presence of God. All he's thinking about is being sure he goes through the ritual in such a way as not to embarrass himself and others. And not only that, he makes meaningless promises. Verse 2, be not rash with your mouth, and let not your heart be hasty to utter anything before God, because God is in heaven, and you are upon the earth. Therefore, let your words be few. Measure your words. Keep your foot. Measure your words when you're in the presence of God. Come near to hear, he says. Come near to listen before you act. People who worship God and never listen. We've got a lot of people who think they're worshiping God. They never listen. They bring to God all their prejudices and they keep them every one. They've decided already what God wants, what pleases Him, what will work out at last, and that's what they keep together in one tight compartment in their minds, and God never influences them, even if they come day after day after day, week after week after week into worship assemblies. They are not changed because they are bold and because they are presumptuous and because they are proud and stubborn and arrogant. Keep your feet when you come into the presence of God. The lack of reverence in this society is awesome. First thing you need to do is draw near to listen. What does Habakkuk chapter 2 verse 20 says? The Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before Him. Remember who God is. We need to know He's the one that sits upon the circle of the earth, and all the inhabitants thereof are like grasshoppers, as Isaiah says in Isaiah 40. He's the one to whom all the nations are like a drop in the bucket. He's the one who has utter and absolute majestic power, who rules over all things, who gives life and breath to all things. He is the one who's righteous altogether, and He's the one who will judge, as Solomon says in Ecclesiastes. He will bring every work into judgment, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And we need to face that with realistic, awestruck reverence when we come into His presence. That's the first thing that people need to do. He's in heaven. We're down here on the earth. He's the one running this show. And we act like we are. And that we'll never have to give an account. Remember who God is. Listen before you act. Learn what He wants. Learn what He feels. Learn what He thinks. And then you'll be in a position to serve Him well and to bless yourself. think before you speak. Some of us sit in here, and I've been guilty. I'm talking about the hymns we sing are tremendous. A few of them, even in our book, though this is, I think, one of the best I've seen. The lyrics are so light and frivolous as to almost be unworthy of singing them, because they don't say anything. And I hasten to add that red book that was published in Indiana, Sacred Selections for the, I've forgotten what it was all about, but Sacred Songs or whatever, had so many of those old Stamps Baxter songs in it that were written for the stage, and all those beautiful alto runs and tenor runs and bass runs that were nothing but to give expression to the virtuosity of the singers and not to say something. Sometimes they said something, but they said it in a slight and light way and said it over and over and over again. Now, I'm not speaking ill of repetition, but some of it was pretty shallow repetition. And we need to sing spiritual songs that have depth to them, and some of these songs have wonderful depth to them. In fact, they make promises to God that are all-encompassing. I surrender all. That's a promise, you know. And when we come into the presence of God, we better think before we speak. Better not to vow, says Solomon, than to vow rashly, heedlessly, and thoughtlessly. We are in the presence of God. We need to listen and think before we speak. Another. Live soberly. Chapter 7. You remember these words? A good name is better than precious oil on the day of death than the day of one's birth. Now that shocks us, doesn't it? It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made glad. What do you mean by all that? Better to go to a funeral than to a wedding. What do you mean sorrow is better than laughter? Who ever heard the like, that it's better to go through life weeping than it is to have laughter? Well, he's not telling you it's wrong to laugh. He's not telling you it's wrong to go to a wedding. In fact, you've already understood that you ought to live joyfully with the wife of your youth. He celebrates marriage. He had his own problems because what he tried to make women was objects of his own pleasure. And he had 1,000 of them, and not any of them brought him any satisfaction. And he said he couldn't find one woman that was true in 1,000. I don't doubt it a bit. He tried to make them the end all and be all, and it cannot be. No marriage can be that, but God can be that. But the point of it all is, sorrow is better than laughter, because we're going to have to face up to the fact that that's what's going to happen to me. This corpse lying in this coffin is not some solitary experience of one human being. I am human too. I had the same basic frailties as this individual, and that's my end too. I better get ready for it. I'm not the one exception who will never die. How is it that by the sadness of the countenance, the heart can be made glad? Because we are sobered by this. Sober living is not life without laughter. Sober living is more filled with joyous laughter than any other kind of living, because it's the life that's already got the important things in place. And now, because we know who we are, who God is, and what life is about, we can go through life laughing with a carefree heart. Can't we? But first, you need to be sober to the realities of life. Rebuke is better than praise, he said. But we like praise. I like it. I don't like rebuke. But rebuke is sometimes necessary in order to correct the course of my life. And as unpleasant as it may be, it's something that can be critical to me. So I seek to learn that lesson. The end is better than the beginning. The day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth.
What? What is he talking about? He's saying that life is a progressive thing, and that it's moving to a determined end, and that the end that God has in mind for us beyond death, above the sun, is greater by far than we have ever experienced here. He's saying that one day we shall awaken from this dream of life and really understand what reality is. And that when we are there, we will look back on this time as something far less than anything that we've ever experienced in the life above the sun. That's what he's saying. And we need to be sure we're taking the journey wisely and not foolishly.
Here's one I want to give you quickly. Solomon gives some counsel about this. Verse 2 of chapter 8, I counsel you, keep the king's command, and that in regard to the oath of God. Don't be hasty to go out of his presence. Do not persist in an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. For the king's word has power, and who may say to him, what are you doing?
Counsel about your attitude towards civil power. I know that he talks in Ecclesiastes about all the injustice in the world and how oppression takes place. Well, after you see enough oppression in the world, and there's plenty of it here, injustice, plenty of it here, and if you let it, you can let it make you bitter, and it may even counsel you to rebel against all established authority, but Solomon says that's foolish. That's not wise. And more than that, the teaching of Jesus bears that out as well. In the language of the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2, he said you ought to submit yourself to the powers that be. Paul said the same thing in the 13th chapter of Romans. You mean to these oppressive powers, to these unjust powers? Yes, Christians can live under the most unjust and oppressive kinds of government, and the early Christians did just that.
It's been interesting in this recent debate over abortion. There is no question in my mind that abortion is a sinful act. That is the taking of an innocent life. But these people who've stood at abortion clinics and taken a gun and killed those people who are responsible for aborting the fetuses, the unborn children of women going in there, have justified that by saying we are preventing murder. We are defending the innocent. Cal Thomas had an editorial recently on that, had an article, not an editorial, in the Courier Journal, which he said, when someone observed this is the way Jesus would have done it, he said Jesus had plenty of opportunity to do that and didn't. He never did it. Not when they killed him. I want to know what you think about that. We have a lot of discussion. It's interesting. Our discussion's about carnal warfare. And the right of self-defense. And that we ought to be able to take the life of somebody trying to kill other people. If you use that argument, the argument of those who have killed the doctors, who are taking the lives of innocent, unborn children, might be sound. Think about it. Injustice may counsel this rebellion, but it's not wise. And Christians can live under adverse circumstances, trusting God. It's not all going to come right here, and you can't make it right. Things crooked are not going to get right. Now, finally, you've been very patient. I get to this one, it's troubled everybody, and I get to it too late. Solomon says, you want to avoid two things. Be not righteous overmuch. Make yourself overmuch. Neither make yourselves otherwise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not wicked overmuch. Neither be foolish. Now,
first of all, we read that and we say, what? What did you say? Don't be righteous. What do you mean? Don't be. Is it possible to be righteous too much? And I thought that any wickedness is too much. What do you mean, overmuch wicked? This is accommodative language, my friend. You've read the rest of the Bible. You know good and well Solomon's not saying here that you ought to be wicked a little, but not too much, and that you ought to be righteous, but don't overdo it. Righteousness is an indivisible thing, just like wickedness. Either it's right or it's not. Either it's wicked or it's not. And when you're dealing with God, righteousness is what His call is for, and wickedness He abominates.
So what is Solomon talking about by being overmuch wicked? I think he's talking about this position that Romans 2, 4 and 5 talks about. The fellow who, because judgment is delayed, who because God doesn't come down and cut him off, is made bold in his wickedness. And the man, as Paul says in Romans 2, stores up for himself wrath in a day of wrath and the righteous judgment of God, because he's not getting an immediate punishment, an immediate retribution. He just goes on and gets bolder and bolder in his iniquity. Don't be foolish. There is a time, Solomon says, when judgment's going to come. Every work's going to be brought into judgment. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, what Solomon was talking about when he said, don't be overmuch wicked. Don't presume that God doesn't care what you're doing. Overly righteous? Yes. Not in the sense that we might think, but he's talking about what Job did. Job began, he got so righteous he was judging God. He told God that what he was doing to him was wrong and unjust. Well, we can't do that. We don't have a platform high enough to stand up and look down on God and say, now what you did is wrong. No man can judge God. That's being too righteous. And the Pharisees, they got too righteous too, in the sense that they began to elevate themselves, proud and arrogant. They weren't really righteous. But they arrogated to themselves a sense of their own personal goodness and righteousness. What we need to do is fear God. That'll humble us. And we'll do what is righteous and good in our lives. And there's a tragedy, Solomon says, in one act of folly. Dead flies cause the oil of the perfumer to send forth an evil odor. So does a little folly outweigh wisdom and honor. Here's perfume being made, and then one dead fly gets in there and that just ruins it all. One dead fly. So a little folly outweighs great wisdom and honor. And his point is simply, don't live your life wisely and well only through one idiotic act. Because you just went to sleep. Because you got your emotions out of control and you got in bed with the wrong man or woman. You just thought, oh, I'm just thinking about this thing and it is so attractive to me. Your emotions drive you and you don't look down the road and see what pain and hurt it's going to cause to other people and the destruction it's going to bring to your relationship with God and the ultimate unhappiness that's going to accrue. Because of this, you don't think about any of those things. You just act without control. That one act can obviate a life of wisdom. How many preachers have I seen through one stupid act destroy their usefulness or cut it in half for the rest of their lives? And that same principle applies to mothers and fathers and husbands and wives and friends and Christians of all stripes and kinds. We need to live our lives with consistency. A commitment to principle. We may make mistakes, but it will not be because we're not trying to do right and trying to be wise. So, final question. How do I tell if God's pleased or disappointed with me? Well, you can't tell by how much money you got, or whether you've got good health, or whether everything's just working out swimmingly. Because Solomon's already told you that the righteous receive the reward of the wicked sometime in this life, and the wicked receive the reward of the righteous. That men die like animals, so far as we can tell under the sun. That the wise man died just like a fool. And there's not any difference under the sun. But I want to tell you something. There's a world of difference above it. And the one way you can know whether God is pleased with you or not is if you fear Him and keep His commandments. You're not going to find this out by saying, well, I'm just a good man. Listen. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 7:10, there's not a righteous man upon the earth that does good and does not sin. Not one. And that same chapter, I think about verse 20, he says that God made men upright, but he sought out many inventions. We have sinned, my friend. And we have to be courageous enough and honest enough to face up to that need. The reason we're going to know that God accepts us and receives us is not because we've been good all our lives and have no cause for regret. It's going to be because we recognize we have not been good and we seek Him. The one who fear God and the ones who fear God and keep His commandments are not the sinlessly perfect people. They're the people who turn their hearts to Him in humble submission and repentance. And you can do that. And you can do it now. And come and be baptized into His Son for the forgiveness.